This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Golden Rule. It is a story of a little sailboat that could. The 39-foot wooden vessel sailed into Hawaii waters this summer, where six decades ago it was the focal point of an anti-nuclear protest. Members of the original crew were jailed in Honolulu in 1958. Its plan to disrupt U.S. nuclear testing in the Pacific thwarted. But the protest was said to have been an early spark for the Greenpeace movement. The Golden Rule was saved from a watery grave in California and was rebuilt, and it made its way across the Pacific to Hawaii once again. It plans to make the journey to the Marshalls, where nuclear testing took place, and then on to Japan to visit Hiroshima and Nagasaki in time for the 64th anniversary of the bombing there. The Golden Rule held an open house this weekend at the Alawai Harbor. We caught up with Bob Broderick dockside yesterday. He, along with his wife, were part of the 1958 protest advocating peace, supported by the Quakers.
It's really amazing, and they did a very fine job in the rebuild. And we took it out actually last night because it was off Diamond Head. They wanted to get a few pictures, and it ended up that the Golden Rule helped pull somebody in who was outside of disabled outside of Alawai Harbor here, and they pulled in another sailboat last night. They're in process doing good. It's amazing.
The Golden Rule still doing good. Helen Jackard is the Golden Rule's project manager. She talked about the significance of take two of this voyage.
When the crew of the Golden Rule was arrested, and this was a very, very public voyage, lots of publicity all over the world, people were really upset, and they had protests to free the crew of the Golden Rule and to let the Golden Rule sail. And it brought enough public attention between what the Golden Rule and the Phoenix did that ultimately it contributed to this giant anti-nuclear movement that convinced Kennedy to sign the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. And then later in the 1970s and 80s, the U.S. was contemplating doing nuclear testing in Alaska. And a group of people were sitting around a table in Vancouver, BC, and they said, let's do something like the Golden Rule did. Let's get a boat and sail it up to Alaska. Okay, what should we call ourselves? Peace, peace. Greenpeace! So that was the start of Greenpeace. And then, of course, a lot of other activist boats came along after that as well. So this boat helped start this big movement of protest and education about nuclear matters. Golden Rule sank in Humboldt Bay in 2010, and she was brought up onto the shoreline and almost used for firewood when Veterans for Peace and some Quakers that originally had sailed the boat decided that it was worth saving her. So they spent 5 years reconstructing Golden Rule, and then we launched into the water in June of 2015 and have been sailing for a nuclear-free world ever since.
So you arrived here in Hawaii, in Hilo, this summer. You're here in Honolulu now. You plan to go to Kauai next, and then eventually across the Pacific back to the Marshalls.
That's correct. If all goes well, then we'll leave Kauai December 15th, and we'll head into the Marshall Islands, arriving in mid-January, and stay there for maybe 3 weeks, and then we'll continue on to Guam, where, there's giant military bases and lots of contamination to deal with there as a result, and then on to Okinawa, where they're using planes to practice attacking North Korea, and where they're building a giant military base that will result in the extinction of the dugong, which is a sea mammal similar to the manatee, and then on to Jeju Island, South Korea, which also experienced the disastrous effects of a military base, and then on to Japan, in time to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the horrific U.S. bombing of the civilian population of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
So where do you plan to dock there in Japan? How is that all working out?
Well, both Hiroshima and Nagasaki are port cities. So there are marinas there that that will accept us. And there are port cities all around Japan. So I think that we'll be going into a lot of places in Japan, talking to them, interviewing the survivors of the atomic bombings, interviewing the evacuees from Fukushima, because it's a really important connection that they're making there, as far as fuel rods being turned into nuclear bombs. The vast majority of our funding comes from small donations when we give lectures talking about the history of the Golden Rule and talking about nuclear and militarism issues today.
So while you're here in Hawaii, what's your plan? You know, who are you networking with?
Well, we reach out to peace activists and social justice people, but we also give talks with Rotary clubs, schools for students of all ages. Our captain will be coming back aboard. He's back in Poland, where he's from. And so he'll be coming back aboard to captain the boat the rest of the way to Japan. And we have a few openings for circumnavigating Oahu and for going to Kauai. So, and we even have, for really experienced sailors, an opportunity to sail from here to as far away as you'd like to go, up to and including Japan, or to hop on for one transit, because we have a rotating crew and they're always qualified. But it's nice to share the joy of sailing Golden Rule with other people. It's really a pleasure to be working on this boat. I had not been a sailor, and it's really nice to be able to sail and to talk about the history and meet all the people that are supporting us. And you know, we meet lots of Quakers and other people that knew of this boat and those two families back in, you know, 1958, and people that are just boat people. They go, wow, what a beautiful boat. She's fairly small. She sleeps four people, but she's got these giant sails. There's a 6-foot diameter peace symbol on our mizzen sail, and there's about a 6-foot diameter Veterans for Peace logo on the mainsail. They're red sails with white logos. You can't miss it if it's out in the bay.
The Golden Rule is supported by the group Veterans for Peace. Ann Wright is a retired Army colonel and a former diplomat who's actively helping to help raise the profile of this journey.
I ended up resigning from the government in 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq. So I was looking around for organizations that kind of were what I had become, which was challenging U.S. government policies by resignation. And I found this group called Veterans for Peace, and so I've joined up with it and have been a proud member ever since 2003.
And so explain your connection with this boat today.
Well, my connection is that as a national project of Veterans for Peace, our whole organization has been supporting it from the day the decision was made that we would help fundraise, and our two chapters help actually physically renovate this little boat. And then being able to keep track of it and give talks here in Hawaii and other places to let people know the value of it, you know, that a little boat sailed 61 years ago to try to challenge atmospheric nuclear testing, and that we need to be, as citizens, we need to be watching out what our government is doing right now on the issue of nuclear weapons. And for us here in Hawaii, where, you know, a year and a half ago we had that big scare that we were all going to die because somebody had fired a rocket at us. And so the level of angst that we should have, because these weapons are available on a moment's notice to be fired off, and the fact that we're spending over $1.5 trillion to refurbish all of these things. And you think of all the things we need to live, education, health, all these sorts of things, and yet we're spending $1.5 trillion to update this massive killing machine.
And you have a number of people that remember this boat when it first entered our ports here.
Yes, indeed. The Quaker House, because the crew, three out of four of the people on the crew were Quakers, and the Quaker House here in our Friends Meeting here in Honolulu supported the boat coming in and gave them hospitality shelter, and were there in the courts every day with them as the crew was arrested and brought to court. And they also organized demonstrations to, there's some great photos in front of the federal building of all of these people saying, stop atmospheric testing. It's putting radioactivity over the whole world. So we do have some people from 1958, 61 years ago, who were a part of that. One of them is Bob Broderick, who has been coming down to the boat to help us do some repairs on the boat. We have a wonderful picture of Bob and Peggy, his wife, sitting on the boat. Others in the Friends meeting, when I've given talks there, I'd ask, how many of you all were here when this happened? And there'll be like five or six hands that go up. And one lady said, yeah, my mother took me by the hand and we went to that court. And we sat in the court because she said, this is important that you hear why these men were doing what they were doing.
So the early peaceniks.
Yeah, they surely were in 1958. They were. The whole issue that people can do crazy things, you know, to highlight what issues that they find most important to them. And the fact that a lot of people donate a lot of money to buy this little boat to start with, and then to renovate it, and then to get it over here. It really was a labor of love, but a labor of social justice to say this boat needs to get back on the high seas and we need to take it into every port along the West Coast. I was just on the giant Japanese peace boat that has 1,100 passengers on the boat, and it's an around-the-world sail. And one of the talks I gave on that boat was about the Golden Rule and about it coming to Japan. And then the level of interest was amazing to me. I mean, all of the Japanese people coming up saying, thank you very much. We need to be remembering, of course, what happened and why it happened. So this boat carries a big message, and we are so thrilled to have it here in Oahu and be able to send her off for another great voyage.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you.
It will be all hands on deck to sand and re-varnish the vessel and get it in tip-top shape to make it across the Pacific in the open ocean crossing, completing the mission it set out to do decades ago. For links to its schedule and a talk next week at the next Quaker meeting on the 17th, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
There's a lot of varnish to scrape off here before she sails again.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're talking about a local plate lunch favorite. The loco moco consists of rice and hamburger patty, smothered in gravy, topped with a sunny side up egg. The story goes that the dish originated in Hilo sometime in the 40s, but there are a few theories on where it was first served. Some say it came from Cafe 100, but according to its website, they make no claim to the creation. Another restaurant that's credited is the long-closed Maze Fountain, but the credit is mostly given to Lincoln Grill Restaurant, which is now closed but was located across the street from Lincoln Park. A group called the Lincoln Wreckers Athletic Club were typical teenagers, short on cash. They'd hang out at Lincoln Grill, and they usually bought Simon and a burger, which never quite filled them up. Stories differ, but in one version, the teens asked the owners to whip up something more satisfying without breaking the bank. Well, apparently they had rice and hamburgers on the menu, and they knew how to make sauces and gravies. From previously working at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Waikiki. The egg would come later. The question we have for you is, who was the chef that owned Lincoln Grill and may have made the first loco moco? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the real estate agents and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HBR's commitment to sharing local stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
A quirky book caught my eye this summer, which prompted me to email the author and invite him to our studios. The title was Fonts in Paradise, Signs of Mid-Century Hawaii. The author, Mark Jonathan Davis, used to live in Hawaii. He transplanted back to L.A., and turns out he's a lounge singer and has a band called the Richard Cheese and Lounge Against the Machine.
Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away that rain? Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come? Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come?
And that was a bit of Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun receiving the Richard Cheese treatment. Here's part of that continuing conversation we had with Richard Cheese about his music.
Well, when I'm not photographing signs in Hawaii, I actually, my real job is a lounge singer. I'm a lounge singer in a band I created called Richard Cheese and Lounge Against the Machine. And what we do is we take rock songs and rap songs from the 90s and 2000s, modern music, and we lounge style perform them. We swankify them into Frank Sinatra style music. So it's kind of like Frank Sinatra singing a song by Red Hot Chili Peppers or Snoop Dogg. So I've been doing that since the year 2000, and we've put out, I think, 22 CDs, and none of them have sold. But we've been doing that for almost 20 years. So we play a lot in Vegas, and we tour around the United States. And our new album comes out in June of 2020. It's called Highball to Hell.
So what possessed you to play around with this music like that?
Well, I love Frank Sinatra, and I love Tony Bennett and Dean Martin and all the Rat Pack era stuff. You know, that era, in addition to being a great era for art, it was a wonderful era for music, especially jazz and swing. So I was really into Frank Sinatra music, but I also really liked the songs that I was hearing on alternative rock radio stations like K-Rock in Los Angeles. So I would listen to songs by Nirvana and songs by the Foo Fighters and songs by, you know, Blink 182. And I sort of thought, well, what if Frank Sinatra were still alive? How would he address these current rock and pop and rap songs? Into what style of music would he convert them? So we kind of put together a jazz big band, and we rearranged these songs into a lounge style. And I've been doing that for, I don't know, since October of 2000, and everyone loves it. I mean, a lot of people tell me, oh, I've been doing that in the shower. I've been singing that way, and now you do it. I'm so glad I can see that live. But we're putting out one more album next year, and we still play in Vegas all the time. So it's a lot of fun.
If you can explain to me the name of your band, what's up with that?
Well, I play this character, you know, Richard Cheese, because the music is so cheesy. That's sort of where I came up with the name. And then when I was trying to come up with a name for the band, I came up with, you know, because Rage Against the Machine is one of the great rock bands of all time. And so I decided to call it Lounge Against the Machine, which is really the essence of what the band is. We're taking hard rock songs and we're kind of making them more laid back. We're taking all of the anger out and making them into just smooth, comfortable, happy, loungy jazz music. So that's why we came up with Lounge Against the Machine. And, you know, we've done songs by rap bands. We've done songs by Ariana Grande. And we do punk rock songs by the Dead Kennedys. But the whole thing is to take them and just, instead of playing with guitars and loud drums, we play with the jazz trio, piano, upright bass, drums, you know, snare drum with brushes, and it sounds really, it's very happy. It's very happy cocktail music, so it's a lot of fun.
And so do you sing? Do you play guitar?
I sing. There's the piano player, there's the drummer, there's the bass player, and I'm the singer. Richard Cheese has played here in Honolulu a few times. We played at Pipeline when it was still open, and we played at Republic, and
The Wave?
Yeah, we played at The Wave. That was the very first time I had come to Hawaii as an adult, and we played at The Wave, and I met a lot of really nice people there, and I became friends with so many people here, and that's one of the reasons that I moved to Honolulu, because everyone was so nice. And we also started another band called Johnny Aloha, and that was Hawaiian music versions of rock songs. So that's this album called Lava Palooza, and that was Hawaiian versions of songs by, we did a song by Katy Perry, Natasha Bedingfield. There's just a bunch of rock songs that we turned into Hawaiian style. So that was sort of a tribute to Don Ho.
So you basically, I wouldn't say hijack.
Oh, yeah, we definitely hijack. We are stealing other people's songs and making them into our own style. But they seem to like it. You know, I've met a few of the artists that we've covered, and they're very, very pleasant. And, you know, we pay royalties to the original songwriters, so it's all above board. But a lot of people are surprised at how the songs sound so good when they're played in a jazz style or a swing style. And I always explain to them, well, that's because the song itself is written well. You know, a song isn't just a recording. It's actually the music and the lyrics on paper. And anyone can play that in any style with any instrument. So you have guys in Waikiki playing for tourists, and they'll play, you know, guitar versions of Van Halen songs. They'll play a guitar version of a song by, I can never think of any bands when I'm doing interviews. They'll play guitar versions of songs that you've heard, you know, on the radio played by a full band, or it's just one guy with an acoustic guitar. So with us, we're doing the same kind of thing. We're taking a song that's basically like a standard. You know, like you look at a song like The Way You Look Tonight, or Night and Day. And those are songs that were written in the 30s and 40s, and they're still being performed today because they're great songs. So what we did is we looked at the charts of today and said, what's the great standard of today? Oh, well, of course, Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. That's a standard. And it really is, because the melody is fantastic. And, you know, the words are obviously kind of silly when you sing them in a jazz style, but that's probably why a lot of people think it's so fun, because they're not expecting you to sing a lyric like that.
Right. So that's the attraction.
Yeah. It's kind of a twist on what everyone already knows. So, you know, Steve Allen used to do this in the 50s and 60s on TV. He used to sing Beatles songs as dramatic ballads. And, you know, it's a style that's usually been done, you know, in vaudeville, and it was done with old songs in the 20s and 30s. People would sing them different ways, and that's really all I'm doing. I'm a cover, you know, I'm a cover band, basically. But we're doing it with a jazz trio, which not enough people get to see jazz music these days. So we're really happy to bring that style to more of an audience.
You're quirky, and I think that's why I like you.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I like your book.
Oh, well, I'm glad. Yeah, you know, I try and do interesting things, because everyone does uninteresting things. So why not do something that no one's doing before? And no one has done a book about signs. I'm really surprised that no one did this sooner. I know there's a lot of Instagram accounts and people take wonderful photos, but to sit down and put them in a book and waste $6,000 on a publisher, that no one has done before. That's quirky, ladies and gentlemen. To spend $6,000 that you do not have on a book that probably won't sell, that's quirky. I don't recommend it, frankly.
Can I put you on the spot? Can you croon something? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't have my accompanist here.
No.
But let me think of a song. Well, this is a song by Snoop Doggy Dogg. You've probably heard of him. He's very popular. The kids love him. His real name is Calvin Brodus. So when I'm doing my shows, I always credit him as the singer. The same way you'd say, this is a song by Cole Porter. Well, this one's by Calvin Brodus. And the chorus goes, rolling down the street, smoking Indo, sipping on gin and juice, laid back with my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Yeah, silly.
Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, that's gin and juice, a classic, a real standard.
Well, Mark Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. If anyone wants to buy my Richard Cheese stuff, you can go to richardcheese.com. We're also on Spotify and YouTube and everywhere else. And we're playing in Vegas, the ninth island. Is it the eighth island or the ninth island? The ninth, right? So we're playing in Vegas at Red Rock Casino in November of 2019 and in March of 2020. And we're hoping to play in Honolulu next summer. So I hope everyone listening will come out and see us. Catherine will be in the front row. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I love this.
All right, Richard Cheese. Mahalo.
Mahalo.
That was Richard Cheese, a.k.a. book author Mark Jonathan Davis. To check out our earlier talk about the Font book, head to HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
The American University in Beirut canceled classes because of street protests. So for a classroom, students and their professor snuck into this old downtown theater that's been closed off for decades.
There are these doorways that open out into two-story drops, rickety ladders that you're supposed to climb across to get to a new level. The staircases have crumbled.
Amid protests, lessons continue in Beirut. It's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Honolulu Civil Beat tackles Hawaii Gas and its place in the green energy landscape. Stuart Yurton covers business issues and joins us this morning with our reality check. Hi there, Stuart.
Hi, Catherine.
So, yeah, Hawaii Gas is catching some flack.
Yeah. Yeah, Hawaii Gas is being targeted, essentially, by the Honolulu City Council, which is saying for new home construction, we want solar water heaters in new homes. And Hawaii Gas is saying, no, we don't want to do we don't want to do that.
Well, yeah, it obviously hurts them. But I think people, probably say, well, if you don't let me have a choice, I might have a problem with that.
Well, that's exactly what Hawaii Gas is hoping. It's asked its customers. It actually sent out letters to its 70,000 customers saying, hey, the city council is doing this. It's going to take away your choice. And join us in opposing this measure.
So tell us about this bill. You know, where is it at?
Yeah, so the bill is the overall construction. It's the energy efficiency bill related to construction. So we have a couple of pieces of it that are getting a lot of attention. One would require a certain percentage of parking stalls in buildings to have residential and commercial buildings to be EV ready, to have the hookups ready so that you could put a charging station in there down the road if you wanted to. This is another piece of that. And again, it's working its way through the council. We don't have the agenda for the next meeting yet, but it should be coming up soon.
And there's other pressure being applied to Hawaii Gas, correct?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So there's also been a push on the state level to say we want to make sure that a certain percentage of Hawaii gas is natural gas, or the natural gas in Hawaii used for electricity production is renewable energy, just like HECO is required to have a certain percentage of renewable energy generating its electricity. So they're getting it on the state level, and they have the city level all looking at it. Again, this is all part of the big push for renewable energy to fight climate change that's part of our state and local government policies. So the gas company is getting caught in that.
Now, they're also experimenting with some wastewater too, right?
That's right. So the idea of a renewable natural gas, it's like, where does that come from? How do you do renewable gas? Well, you can do it from waste. So, it's kind of a not a pretty thought, but yes, it comes from our waste, our human waste and wastewater that can be converted, basically the methane harvested from that and refined into natural gas that can burn.
Right, so they are trying to be green.
They are. That's right.
And
they're
so,
working on it.
Yeah. So,
but there's only so much waste, to use a euphemism that we have, and so they're kind of limited as to what they can do.
Okay. So so how does that sit then going forward? There's that rub.
There's the rub, and again, the city and the Josh Stanbro, the chief executive officer of the sustainability office, is saying, "Look, we really need to do this. We want to, you know, we need to push this. We need more renewable energy and less carbon energy." So. Yeah, they're pushing it. Environmentalists are pushing it. Even HECO is pushing it, saying, hey, wait a minute, we have to live up to the standard. What about the gas company? And the gas company's pushing back, saying it's just not feasible for us to do it.
Right. I mean, they've been around for, 115 years or something like that, right?
Right. They've been around a long time. And again, one of the things to bear in mind is it's a very, very small amount of our total energy consumption comes from natural gas. We put it on a pie chart compared to everything else, and it doesn't even show up on the pie chart. It's such a small amount of our energy that it's like a stripe on the pie chart that's so small it's invisible. So it's a very small amount of energy that we use from natural gas for here in Hawaii.
Okay, so we'll have to kind of watch these bills and see where they go.
That's right.
But thanks so much, Stuart.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read his story about Hawaii Gas, go online to civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Cole Academy Child Development Centers, now open on Hawaii Island for children in Kona Kohala ages 6 weeks to 6 years. More at thecoleacademy.com.
I'm Jeff White. I'm a certified financial planner. I've been a proud underwriter of HPR since 2005. HPR gives different points of view. I like that a lot, and there's no other source in town that I think provides that same kind of intellectual stimulation, and so I value that.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting, your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We heard from many of you following our Friday rebroadcast of our electric vehicle show.
Hi, this is Randy Evanson. I live in Makawao. And in regard to the charging stations and electric vehicle talk, the incentives are for wealthy people, not for anyone else. So if you want more adaptation of electric vehicles, make the tax incentives apply to everyone, not just somebody who makes $100,000 or more a year. If I could get the $7,500 tax credit from the feds, I would be buying an electric vehicle because some of them are within reasonable cost once you do that. But otherwise, you know, it makes it out of my price range. That extra $7,500 tax incentive really helps. Similarly, in regard to the parking at the airport, again, this is an incentive only for the wealthy because, A, only the wealthy can typically fly anywhere. I haven't been off this island in a year and a half. So, you know, the people who are getting these tax cuts to buy the cars are then getting a nice incentive to park at the airport. Well, it doesn't serve the common person. So that's really my comment. Thank you. Good day.
Hi, I'm Alejandro from Maui, and I would like to know, because you are talking about the electric cars, every time we go to the pump station, when we put fuel on the tanks, it is a tax, and that tax goes to the road. Those cars have not paid anything, and I'm wondering how the state will deal with that, especially since we will have soon trucks and buses that ruin our roads and they don't pay anything for the roads they use. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Mike Last. I live on Hawaii Island down at South Point. About the electric vehicles, it seems pretty counterproductive if I have to go 80 miles to Hilo. 80 miles each way to Hilo, that's 160 miles. How much residual do I have once I'm up in Hilo to ride around? I would be really concerned about not having enough energy to get home.
And following our show on Kapu'aloha and the Kahuku Wind Farm Project, we got a long email from Barbara. I'll read just part of it. The protesters at the Kahuku Wind Farm have nothing in common with the civil rights movement. Sometimes, despite your most valiant efforts, a decision is made that you don't like. Grown-ups either accept that as the price we pay for living in this society or go through proper channels to make changes. Being bullies and blocking roads and destroying someone's property or lying about what the police did to you are not ways to affect change. I cannot respect any person or radio station who gives glory to the bullies and ignores the fact that people are just trying to do their jobs and take care of their families. I'm not Hawaiian, but I've lived in Hawaii for over 35 years. This is my home, and I have no intention of leaving. But I'm no longer able to enjoy Hawaiian music and culture. And Joe Wilson from the North Shore shared this. The invisible elephant in conversations about Kahuku and La'ie is the major land and property developer, Hawaii Reserves, Inc., representing the interests of the Mormon Church. Why is HRI not speaking out on behalf of local residents? Hey, thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. In today's backyard quiz, we're going gravy all over and talking about the loco moco. Today's there's variations with prime rib or ahi for the protein, risotto for the rice, and quail eggs instead of chicken. But the rice, homemade beef patty, gravy, and runny egg is the way most locals know it, and the way it was served in Hilo more than 50 years ago. The most common origin story involves the Lincoln Wreckers Athletic Club, which was a group of teens who played sports. They would hang out at the Lincoln Grill restaurant, listening to the jukebox and playing with the pinball machine. The kids didn't have that much money and asked the owners, Richard and Nancy Inouye, to create the dish, and they say the rest is history. And while they made the dish, the teenagers chose the name. The first teen to eat it was supposedly nicknamed Crazy, which translates to loco in both Portuguese and Spanish. Moco rhymes with loco, and the name stuck. That's today's quiz. We had no winners, but if you have an idea for a quiz, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The state and city and county gave away thousands of trees this weekend as part of Arbor Day activities across the state. Working with volunteers from many nonprofits, we had an opportunity to talk about history with Kevin Eckert, who is a certified arborist working with smart trees.
Arbor Day in Hawaii started in 1905 when there was a proclamation and they got a lot of kids together and they got schools going on, planted a lot of trees at the very beginning. And that was born out of the National Arbor Day that was started in Nebraska in, I think it was 1872, when they decided that, you know, trees weren't getting their due and they wanted to get more education, more people planting trees. So Hawaii, of course, has always been very tree-centric, I think, anyway. So.
But why November when everybody else across the country
it's
is
April.
In spring?
It is spring, rainy season. So, you know, of course, in on the mainland in the temperate climates, it starts in April or so. That's the planting time, because that's when trees are waking up. They're getting their moisture. They've been through the cold winter. They're relatively dormant. So that's when planting time on the mainland typically is. But for us, planting time is not. So we switched it to make it more conducive to our seasons.
And then this whole idea of the tree giveaway.
Well, for me, the tree giveaway is a hook. We want to get trees out in the ground, but more importantly, it's not about numbers of trees so much. Certainly, we want to get as many trees as we can, but it's all about right tree, right place. So when I first got involved in this in 1994 with Hawaiian Electric Company, we were looking at ways that we could educate people on right tree, right place, so we could get a more sustainable urban forest, and also we could keep the trees out of the power lines. Because this is a big problem for all of us. We need a good balance, like you do with many things. So the hook, we knew people would come in to get trees, free trees, and we could give them free trees, and we could tell them a wonderful story. And one of the stories is, how do you plant your tree? First of all, how do you select a tree? How do you determine what's the right tree? I mean, I might like monkey pods. I might love monkey pods. But in my yard, not big enough. Too close to the sidewalk, too close to the house and these things. So I want a tree, but there's other trees that are more suitable. And of course, we don't want them planted under the power lines either, because it just creates a problem for the tree and the power and everybody around it. So that was the way it started. And it's really continued on like that. And we've got a bigger group out here now. We're doing the giveaway, and we've kind of grown into more of a, I don't know, an affair, if you will, where we've got demonstrations, climbing demonstrations. Of course, we're still doing the education. We have the Ask the Arborist going on, and kind of a more of an event than just come pick up your tree and go home and put it in the ground.
Well, I think people are hungry for education. They want to learn more about how do you select the right tree for your yard. I mean, you could put in grass, but if your yard doesn't get sun, you know, and maybe that's the, you have a sun-loving variety. So it's you know,
well, and
learning
trees are,
about it.
There's so many benefits that people don't even realize. I mean, there's the shade. Everyone knows shade. People know about carbon sequestration, where it's getting energy down. But the social, the psychological, the community benefits are very well studied, but not out there so much. Watershed management, prevention of erosion, I think people know. But collecting water and keeping it from going into the sewers saves us money and impacts on our system. The other thing is that's important for us to let folks know is once you get the tree, you get the right tree for the right place, you have to put it in the ground properly. If you don't plant it properly, then it's not going to survive. And then early establishment care is very important. And then, of course, as they go along, as they get mature, pruning them properly, not too much, doing it just right, looking at nutrients and pests and things, and managing them properly so they do well. Because when you look in our urban environment, which is so important to have trees, they're not in a great spot. It's always curious to me is how well they survive considering the environment they're in. But they do well, but we need to help them out a little bit so that they will do well and they'll be real stewards for us, real benefits for us.
And the city's embarked on a big campaign now to plant more trees just because we've lost a lot of our canopy over the years.
Our canopy, we've done some research on that, and I'm going to say, I mean, that's the years up, but 7 years ago, we did an initial canopy study of the urban forest in the southern half of Oahu. And then a couple of years ago, we did a five-year recount, and we were lost almost 5% of our urban canopy in that area. And, of course, that appalls us. We want to be picking it up. And a lot of it's little onesies and twosies. Not like people are clearing massive amounts of land, but you're missing one here. We're doing a development here. A tree dies. They don't replace it. You know, we run into those kind of challenges. So we really need to take a more focused effort on identifying these opportunities.
And here in Kailua, I know there was a program to map the trees on this side, and the volunteers did an incredible job mapping thousands of trees over a period of a couple of years, and now you're branching out to other communities in town.
Exactly. The Citizen Forester Program is one that we've initiated through the Department of Forestry and Wildlife, Smart Trees Pacific, the group I'm involved with, is the one that's driving, or the on the ground, we're administering, I should say, and it's under grants from the U.S. Forest Service as well as other funding sources, where we're getting the community involved. I mean, community trees are about us, about our community. You know, we don't want to go in and say, well, you should plant this. You tell us what you want to plant, where you need trees. So we started in Kailua, and we are absolutely branching out into other areas. We want to take it statewide to get the communities engaged, to get an inventory of what they have, and then what they don't have, and then where we can strategically place the right tree in a location and get the community to take care of them, for it to be their trees.
And it is a challenge, because I know, talking with the city's Urban Forestry Division, they say they're having trouble keeping employees, they have a lot of vacancies, and they can only water so many trees. I think it's like 70 or 80 trees, yeah. I think, that Linda's got her team out mm-hmm. there every day. But they do need the community's help in kind of watching out for these trees once they've been planted as street trees?
Absolutely. I mean, the city team is doing a wonderful job, and an underappreciated job. I mean, people complain to them, and they're having to put out fires all the time. So the work that they want to do, that we need them to do, they're not able to put the time in. So this just is a great opportunity for us to leverage our community people, tree lovers in our community, people that are stakeholders, to get involved and help us. The city, I mean, after all, who's the city? It's us, it's the community. So this will help them leverage that resource into taking, getting more trees in the ground and taking care of those trees.
Do we have a handle on, let's say, of the trees that we gave away or that we planted, how many survived?
Excellent question, and it's a question that we have as well. We take surveys at these, and of course we get mixed responses, and sometimes people don't want to admit their tree didn't make it. I'm not sure I would.
Okay, I got a coach tree last Arbor Day and mine died.
Yeah, and you know what, and that happens. We understand that. I mean, we're not about numbers so much as sustainable quality trees in the ground. I go back to right tree, right place, not massive numbers. There's a number of operations that are trying to put 1,000 trees and 10,000 trees or whatnot, and of course, as an arborist, I think that's wonderful, but I'm afraid we need to focus more on making sure we put trees in judiciously, appropriately, and then care for them afterwards, and that's the challenge, as you mentioned, with the city.
Right, you want them to thrive.
You want them to thrive, exactly. It's not survivability. And unfortunately, over the years I've been in Hawaii and watching many of the wonderful community plantings, many of them don't survive. We're all there, we show up, we put them in the ground, we get our picture taken, and then they're not cared for. And sometimes good-hearted folks don't put the right tree in the first place. And then someone comes in and it interferes. I mean, that's the whole idea back to the community. What do you want here? What's your goal with your tree? What are you looking for? Let's put that tree in there so it suits your needs. And you will not only enjoy that tree, you'll protect that tree and take care of it.
That was Kevin Eckert, certified arborist, talking to us at the recent tree giveaway at the Kailua Methodist Church. And a heads up, the Ilani Kailua Outdoor Circle will be holding a fundraising tree event later this month.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University's Choirs and Orchestra, with music about the moon, stars, planets, and the spirit of exploration, November 15th at St. Andrew's Cathedral, hpu.edu/arts@hpu.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. You probably know about the Cold War arms race, but what about the farms race?
Things like chicken breeding and hybrid corn took a outsized role in U.S. propaganda.
And one of the biggest weapons in this food fight?
Literally airlifting a 10,000 square foot supermarket into Yugoslavia.
How the supermarket helped America win the Cold War. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Tonight at 7, following Counterspin.
That is it for today. A special report on impeachment will preempt our show tomorrow. But hey, you know, we still like your feedback. Call our talk back line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them all on The Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. And you know what? We're going to leave you with some Richard Cheese music. Enjoy.
Don't you know I suffer? Hey, baby, can't you hear me moan? You caught me under false pretenses. How long before you let me go? Oh, you set my soul alight. Ooh, you set my soul alight. Glaciers melting in the dead of night. The superstars sucked into the supermassive. Glaciers melting in the dead of night. And the superstars get sucked into the supermassive. Ladies and gentlemen, from the band Muse, on drums, Dom Howard is not here. Sorry.